This is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Friday, May 2020, producing from his home studio in Connecticut, Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney, and I'm working from my home studio just north of New York City. And Taylor, today's a big day for us. We get to unveil our Terry Francona interview.
Oh my God. I had to brush some dust off of it yesterday. It's a hot commodity. It's been discussed on email chains at the worldwide leader here. And, we got a request from the guys at Golic & Wingo. They're looking for sound. So this truly is a big day for the podcast. I'm very excited for people to hear this.
Yeah. So we did this interview. I want to say it was like 4 weeks ago, maybe 4.5 weeks ago. And it was Terry Francona talking about Michael Jordan's time in baseball. Because when Michael Jordan played baseball in the summer of 1994 for the AA Birmingham Barons, Terry Francona was his manager. And he has so many stories, he's so many great anecdotes. But that was at about the time that the decision was made to move up this tremendous series we're seeing every Sunday night, The Last Dance, about Michael Jordan. And so, rightly so, the thought process was, you know what, let's save that podcast interview for the Friday before they talk about Michael Jordan's time in baseball on The Last Dance. But it's been burning a hole in our pocket, Taylor.
I know. You especially have been like, can we just get this dang thing out already? But here, today is the day.
All right. Before we get to that, some news and notes. The Phillies' Bryce Harper wants major leaguers in the Olympics. He spoke with Barstool Sports Starting Nine podcast. He called it a quote-unquote travesty. Major leaguers aren't in the Olympics, saying it's the perfect way to grow the game worldwide. Baseball returned to the Tokyo Olympics for the first time since 2008. Taylor, real quick, it'll never happen. Because here's the bottom line. Good in order know. For major leaguers to play in the Olympics, they would have to take a break in the middle of the summertime when kids are out of school in the United States and they're typically filling major league parks, and there's no chance Major League Baseball would say, yeah, go ahead, take 4 weeks off.
Interesting. I mean, they do that. The hockey is way different, but they do that for the Olympics, with the NHL and, you know, with the MLS, you know, again, different sport, different gravity to the whole thing, but they do it for the World Cup. It's interesting to me that baseball will cling to them and stop them from going. But, good to know, Buster, that, that's not going to be happening.
No, it's the middle of the summertime. Right. Baseball is so seasonal, and it feels like some of the other sports aren't as affected in the same way. This from the Associated Press. Six organizations that aid survivors of domestic violence are among groups that will receive $50,000 each from Major League Baseball. And the Players Association is part of a Healthy Relationships Community Grant Initiative. Major League Baseball and the union committed to donating $3 million from the joint charitable fund. This is in the New York Post today. According to multiple sources, Alex Rodriguez and Jennifer Lopez are no longer interested in buying the Mets. That decision was reached after negotiations with potential partners failed to materialize, and it became clear that the Wilpons, the owners of the Mets, their reluctance to part with SNY, the network, makes it impossible, almost impossible for anyone without many billions of dollars to afford owning the team. Before we get to Tito and to Todd Radom, a chief executive of our weekly quiz, don't forget about episodes 7 and 8 of The Last Dance on Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern on ESPN. In episode 7, we're finally getting a look at Michael Jordan giving baseball a shot with the White Sox organization after retiring from the NBA for the first time. Then check out Jalen and Jacoby's After Show podcast featuring The Last Dance director, Jason Hare, available every Sunday night immediately after the show. Listen to Jalen and Jacoby, The After Show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. Todd Radom is the chief executive of our weekly quiz. He's a graphic artist whose work can be seen on ball fields all across America, all around the world, or you can go to his website, toddradom.com. Todd, how you doing this week?
I am doing all right, Buster. It is May, and here we are. We're all hunkered down. It's good to talk with you guys.
Yeah, and how about the weekend forecast in my home state of Vermont? Snow.
Yeah, I saw May. A polar vortex. I mean, come on. What is this?
It's not fair. It's just not fair. But today is a good day because we get to run the Terry Francona interview that we did weeks ago. I had such a great and fun conversation with Tito, who's a great storyteller. He and Jordan have a lot of affection for each other, a lot of respect for each other. I mentioned to him, I can't remember because the interview was a long time ago. I can't remember how I framed our conversation about Michael as a player, because I got to tell you, the first time I watched batting practice or videotape of Jordan taking batting practice, I was like, okay, that's not going to work. So it's very interesting that Francona, in our conversation, was much more positive about where Michael was in his progression as a ball player. What do you remember about that time?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like a little bit of context goes a long way, of course. This is a time that the internet was in its infancy. No Twitter, no hot takes, anything like that, obviously. My recollections, Buster, were that this was you know, this was a joyous thing happening. The greatest, most electric athlete in the world trying something different in our sport of baseball. I thought it was really cool. I really did. And, you know, I remember thinking, like, give the guy some benefit of the doubt. He's a world-class athlete, best perhaps, you know, ever to play his game. And I think I remember a couple of other things. I remember, first of all, you know, having a little bit of insight into the minor leagues at that point and having the minor leagues exposed, the bus rides, the whole thing, and just the incongruity of Michael Jordan taking place, you know, taking part in a situation like this. And then finally, Buster, I remember being very sad in, you know, the way it all ended up with replacement players feeling kind of cheated. Who knows if the guy ever would have made it, but, you know, it was just a fascinating thing, and why not?
Yeah, and I remember, and I'm going to ask Tito about this in our interview, the Sports Illustrated cover about Jordan playing baseball, the cover said, "Bag it, Michael." I remember seeing that and being absolutely jarred by it, and I've gotten it, you know, the person who wrote that article is my friend Steve Wolf, who works with us at ESPN, and, you know, I've had conversations with him about the reaction to that. And, you know, I was thinking about in recent days, we've heard from Charles Barkley that Michael and Charles have never settled their differences. It's about a decade old. They don't talk anymore. And I thought, yeah, that's why Steve Wolf, you know, is fairly confident that Jordan would never forgive Sports Illustrated for that cover.
Oh, I'm sure of it. And some of the Barkley stories are unbelievable. And it's really been entertaining to watch this thing. But, yeah, I mean, just again, the minor leagues, Michael Jordan riding buses with guys who were, you know, going to plateau at a certain, I mean, it was just an amazing time. So I'm looking forward to the Tito interview, because I'm sure he, as always, brings a lot to the table for conversation.
A lot of stories, a lot of humor, and a lot of perspective, that's for sure. All right. This week, we're talking about Chase Field in Phoenix. You're the expert, so I'm going to defer to you on Chase Field. I have one story that I'll never forget about that place.
I think I know what your story is going to be, but, you know, we're tasked with talking about Chase Field. I won't use the term airplane hangar, which maybe I just did. you know, listen, Buster, clearly this place, just the first, you know, bullet points, it is cavernous. It is massive. Built at a time when capacity was king, but, you know, it just seems way, way too big now, and there's no way to really correct that. Here are the pros. Hey, it's air-conditioned, right? I mean, Arizona in the summer, having a vast air-conditioned space. I remember being there for All-Star back in 2011. It was a very good thing to have that. And I do like the fact that it is in downtown Phoenix. It's walkable to places. You've got some bars and restaurants just, you know, right in the proximity, and that you want to be walking around in the middle of July necessarily in search of food and drink. Unique features. We would be remiss if we didn't mention the swimming pool, 8,500 gallons. We would then be remiss if we didn't remember the 2013 Dodgers doing cannonballs into the pool, celebrating.
And whatever else they were doing in the pool.
Oh, I don't want to even want to know, especially now when we're all skeeved out about personal hygiene and germs. and just lastly, Buster, I do miss the dirt strip, the keyhole that used to run from home plate to the pitcher's mound. Not necessarily a unique feature. I'm pretty sure Comerica Park in Detroit still has that. But I do miss it. It gave a little bit of personality to a building that doesn't have a whole lot of personality.
Okay, I'll give you the backstory on that dirt strip running from home plate out to the pitcher's mound, and actually was decisive in the Diamondbacks' only championship. That dirt strip was designed by Buck Showalter, who, of course, had taken over the Diamondbacks. He had a lot to do with the design, as you know, not only the ballpark, but also the uniforms, the clubhouse, the whole thing. He had a lot of input in. And Buck told me that his thought was when they do those aerial shots over the ball fields, he wanted people, when they saw the blimp shot of a night game, he wanted people to know, oh, of course, that's Chase Field or whatever it was called at the time. I can't even remember.
Bank One Ballpark, the Bob.
Yeah, that's exactly right. He wanted people to be able to recognize it from those air shots. So they put in the dirt strip. Now, the reason why it was decisive, if you remember, in the middle of that ninth inning rally by the Diamondbacks in the bottom of the ninth inning, there was a bunt that went right back to Mariano Rivera. And it went back to him. Absolutely, it was burning. It was going fast, and it surprised him. And it went along that strip of dirt. And if you go back and look at the replay, it was going so fast, the bunt back to him, because it was on dirt and it wasn't on grass, it almost went between his legs. But when he picked up the ball, there was a runner at first base. Because it got to him faster than he expected, he picked up the ball and turned to fling it, but he had an improper grip on it. He actually put it in the palm of his hand rather than on his fingertips, and he threw the ball in the center field. And so that dirt strip that was envisioned first by Buck Showalter turned out to be pivotal in that ninth inning rally, which I, you know, cool story that I always liked. I told that to George Steinbrenner once, the former Yankees owner. He didn't like that story.
No. What a great World Series, too. Just got to say that. And Buster, I just left a fat fastball, slow fastball right up the middle for you because somebody I know wrote a book about that moment in that World Series, the last night of the Yankee dynasty.
Yeah, I appreciate that. That was absolutely a fat fastball. All right, let's get to this week's quiz.
All right, guys, here we go. Which one of these events occurred most recently? A, the Milwaukee Brewers appeared in a World Series. B, Robinson Cano was born. C, the All-Star Game was played at Dodger Stadium. Or D, the Minnesota Twins moved into the Metrodome. Which one of these events occurred most recently? Brewers appearing in a World Series. Ah. Robinson Cano being born. The All-Star Game being played at Dodger Stadium. Or the Minnesota Twins moving into the Metrodome.
Man, oh man. Taylor, go ahead. You're on a winning streak here.
I think this might be the day where that comes to an end, but I'm going to go with Robinson Cano being born.
Oh, man.
Bring in the heat, Todd.
Yeah, and Todd, I'm going to go, since we're a little bit topical last week, we talked to Jana Marie Smith about Dodger Stadium. That's where the All-Star Game is supposed to be. And I just wonder if you were looking for a way to include Dodger Stadium in this conversation, so that's my pick.
No, I wasn't at all. Taylor is right. Robinson,
oh, my goodness.
No, I was going to pick Cano first, and then I thought, you know, Todd, he's very topical. He has a way of, oh, my God, that's three in a row I've dropped.
You're overthinking it.
Robinson Cano was born on the 22nd of October, 1982. The Milwaukee Brewers played Game 7 of the 1982 World Series on October 20th. The All-Star Game was last played at Dodger Stadium in 1980. The Minnesota Twins move into the Metrodome in 1981. So there you go.
Oh, my gosh. So I picked the last one, actually. Yeah, and it was so funny because right away when you gave me the Cano and the Brewers one, I'm like, okay, I know which one of those two is most recent, but I absolutely blew it. Taylor, congratulations. You're on a winning streak. Todd, get out of here.
Back I go to my basement and my pandemic beard.
Terry Francona has managed 19 years in the big leagues, the last seven with the Cleveland Indians, and his teams won the World Series in 2004 and 2007. But today we brought him on to talk about the second of his 3 years as the manager of the Birmingham Barons and manager to a middle-aged outfielder named Michael Jordan. Tito, thanks for doing this.
My pleasure, Buster.
Now, before we get to that, how are you doing during this downtime?
You know, it's such a unsettling time. You know, I think unsettling is the best word. I mean, my goodness, you know, we all miss baseball. That's a given. But there are so many other things going on that take precedent over, you know, I mean, just you turn on the TV and you watch what's going on and you just hope you know, that people are going to be okay. And the quicker, the better. And then when it's time, you know, our game will come back. And my hope is it'll almost be like a celebration. That would be really cool.
Yeah. We all remember, you know, how important baseball was right after 9/11 and how it helped to heal and provide a distraction for people.
That would be the hope again, as far as I'm concerned. That would be terrific.
So I was thinking about this because I've been around teams when guys have switched sports and try to go from one sport to another, that there's that great competitive arrogance where people are like, oh yeah, really? He thinks he can come over and do this? So as I got ready for this interview with you, I was thinking to myself, I wonder how Terry felt the first time that you heard the possibility that Michael would switch from basketball to baseball. If you can remember sort of how your initial, you know, competitive feeling about it.
Well, what I remember first is it was during the off season and I was watching him. They had, you know, video clips of him hitting in Chicago and Walt Riniak was helping him. And I remember thinking, man, he's trying to hit like Walt wants him to hit and he doesn't even know how to hit yet. And I just thought the cart was getting put ahead of the horse. And he will, you know, he's a long levered guy anyway. And I thought, boy, this has got a chance to be kind of ugly here, you know, and, you know, let the guy hit for a while and then see what, you know, what's there and what's not and what you can do and make some adjustments. So I thought that made it harder on him originally.
Now, what was your first contact with him?
My first contact was when they announced that he was going to be with the Birmingham work group. And I think there was probably only 3 or 4 days left in spring training. And I remember because I, you keep your eyes open and everybody wanted to be Michael's coach, you know, and you can understand why, you know, everybody wanted to get a piece of him. And I think when he saw me coming, he's like, oh my God, here comes another guy. And I just introduced myself. And I said, hey, look, I said, why don't you just kind of let your, you know, get your feet wet and get to know the guys. I said, when we get to Birmingham, we can sit down and talk and, you know, if you have questions, I'll answer them or, you know, things like that. And I think he got like a look of relief, like, oh my goodness, like, okay, that's one less guy right now. Cause everybody wanted a piece of him.
And I'm sure subsequently, as you got to know him a little bit better, did he ever tell you that he was glad you approached it that way?
I never really remember talking about that anymore. I do know that getting to know him like I did, once he trusted you, you know, he trusted you. But you know, and he'd let his guard down. But that was hard for him to do. And I don't blame him. I mean, after watching his life and the way people try to get at him, I was amazed at his the amount of patience and just how he would handle some things. And so I guess I lived it firsthand. You know, I saw it up close, and I just, you know, again, after when you start riding buses with guys and you're together 16, 18 hours a day, the guard comes down and you see the guy for what he really is, not what you see on TV.
How would you, cause you had played in the big leagues. Of course, you've been around professional sports your whole life. How would you describe his level of celebrity versus what you had seen before that?
Well, I mean, he's arguably the most high profile, maybe athlete in the world. I mean, the biggest thing I think we had going for us, as like, you know, me, Barney and Champ, the coaches, were that, you know, he was on our turf, and especially me. I mean, I'd been in a baseball clubhouse since I was 3 years old. So there was nowhere I was more comfortable. So I think that really helps, like, cause people used to always say, oh man, are you intimidated? Or, well, hang on. I was in the place where I was the most comfortable that I could ever be. And Michael was kind of coming into our world. And thankfully, not only was he coming into our world, but he was respectful about the way he came into it. And that made it really helpful.
I'm curious, too, what was your sense of what he was trying to accomplish as he joined you guys?
I think he was totally legit in what he said. I'm not sure he knew what he was wanting to accomplish, other than I know if you told him no, he would try to make the answer be yes. I think he genuinely got burned out on what he was doing. You know, and his dad died and things, you know, he just, this is just a way to maybe clear his head. And I don't know if he had an ultimate goal. I mean, to get to the major leagues, everybody would say that, but I don't know if he thought it that far ahead. I never really felt the need to ask him. You know, he was great to the guys. He was really good to me and the coaches. And so it worked. And you know, it had all the makings of a circus, and yet it never became that. And I give Michael the vast majority of the credit because of the way he handled it.
Before I ask you about what you saw in him as a player, tell me what your sense of was his relationship with baseball. Because you've been around it. I mean, you have Dustin Pedroia played for you and Derek Jeter. Those guys are dirt balls. And my sense is that Michael, in that respect, I mean, that was a perfect fit for baseball, that he was a worker.
Oh, he wanted to learn every, like, the jargon. You know, he was in it, man. I mean, he wanted to learn, you know, and he had a lot to learn, but he knew it. And that made it a lot easier to be patient, because he knew he had a lot to learn. I mean, he handled himself so well around the players and around the team, and he certainly wasn't afraid to work. And I just remember one day, and I don't want to say the name, but I took a kid out for not hustling, and Michael was supposed to have a day off, and he ended up going in the game, and he dove headfirst into second base to break up a double play. And I remember going out to get his helmet, and I said, "Hey, man, are you crazy?" And he's like, "Well, I know what you were trying to do there." It was his way of trying to show the other kid, "Hey, you play hard." Now, he almost killed himself, but I mean, that was Michael. He had a way of, he saw everything.
How would you describe him? You mentioned what you saw in him as a hitter initially. What did you see in him as a defender and a base runner?
You know, I thought it was hard for him all year throwing, because, you know, you go from not throwing for 14 years to a situation where, you know, in the minor leagues, you take infield every day. And so his arm was hanging all year, and I knew it was. And you know, so that was hard for him. He went left and right really good. I mean, he really did. In and out, it was still a little bit of a, you know, there'd be a misstep every once in a while. But he also, I think he stole 30 bases. He was a player that hadn't played in 14 years, goes to Double-A, and hit just a tad over 200, but drives in 50 and steals 30, he'd be a prospect in anybody's organization. I don't think it was fair to even ask if he could get to the big leagues until he had about 1,800 at-bats. I would say that about anybody. But like I told you earlier, I found out quickly, if you told him no, he'd find out a way to make the answer be yes.
What are some things you saw in him? You touched on a little bit. You saw in him as a teammate. You know, he's an older superstar with professional athletes who are younger than he is, and I'm guessing that some of them were initially starstruck.
Yeah, but Michael had a pretty good way about him, about, you know, he could see through guys that were genuinely his friends, or guys that, you know, he obviously, he's pretty street smart guy. And the guys I thought that maybe said things about him that were not disparaging, but maybe that he was taking their place or something, I don't think that was ever very well thought out. I mean, Michael didn't take anybody's place. We had an opening in the outfield in Birmingham, and that's probably why they sent him there. And he treated guys well. The guys that deserved to be treated well, he treated them well. Like, he knew if he signed a couple baseballs after a game, we were probably going to eat better that night rather than pizza and hot dogs, you know, like normally. And he didn't mind doing stuff like that. But I don't know. You know, we tried so hard to treat him like everybody else, knowing that that was virtually impossible. But the more you could, the better off everybody was, he himself included.
Now, you know far better than I do, the two toughest things about playing in the minor leagues professionally, the travel and the food. You touched on the food a little bit. He went and got in his own bus. What was that like?
Well, when we came to Birmingham, we met like I said we would. He asked me, you know, he goes, one of the first questions was, he goes, do we fly? And I was like, oh man, this is going to be rough. I said, no, man, we bus everywhere. And I said, it's actually not that nice a bus. And he was like, well, what if I could get us a bus? And I'll be damned. The next day, I think like four buses showed up and they were beautiful. You know, one was like for a rock group. And I was like, hey, this is good for me, you, Champ, and Barney, but what about the 24 other players? You know, so we kind of kept, you know, dismissing the buses. And finally, we ended up getting a new bus. I don't think it was even the best bus in the league. Didn't have sleepers. It didn't, you know, but it was new, so it didn't smell. And it certainly didn't break down as much as the old one. They had him sign the door, and they called it the Jordan Cruiser. And they used to take it on junkets up to Tunica, Mississippi. I think the bus company made out like crazy. so there was a lot of, you know, things said about it, you know, that you had a wet bar, had a jacuzzi. It was just a bus. It looked like the old Partridge Family bus, the way it was colored.
Now, how did his presence change the way that minor leaguers ate?
Well, again, we knew, you know, after a game, if he'd sign a couple balls or something, there was a decent chance at a restaurant somebody would drop some food off for us. So more often than not, you know, we'd make a couple deals, you know, that we were good at that. And we'd try to have a little bit better food. So for 1 year, I think there were times where we ate better than a lot of double-A guys.
How did he like, and Tim Kirkchin has talked about this because you told him stories about this. What were ways that you guys passed times during those long hours of travel?
You know, and that was the funny part because, you know, some of those bus rides are miserable. I mean, there's no getting around it. You can survive the Southern League. You know, you can probably play anywhere. And I used to look at him and think, you know what? He's happy because nobody can get at him, you know. I mean, I'm sure his legs got stiff and, you know, cause he was so tall and everything, but he was able to let his guard down and shoot. We play Yahtzee. I mean, he'd be in the back for a while playing cards. He'd come up in front with us. It took me a while, but I finally understood that the biggest thing was he was able to let his guard down because there was absolutely nobody that could get at him on that bus.
What were the Yahtzee games like?
They were competitive. I mean, now you got to know going in, if you're going to play against him, and I don't care what it is. I mean, I've seen him break tennis rackets. I've seen him break ping pong paddles. If you're going to compete against him, you better be ready to compete because it doesn't matter what you're doing. He's going to try to beat you.
So how did the first pickup basketball game come about? Because you know that there were probably guys on your team just dying for that to happen.
Yeah, and I didn't want that to ever happen because that had bad written all over it. You know, it just wasn't going to be good. So we stayed away from that. But the apartment complex I lived in, and it wasn't in a great area, and it was had a blacktop, you know, basketball court and had chain nets. But Champ and Barney were sitting behind me, and they were popping off about basketball and you know, they were just messing around, and what, Michael's ears perked up, and the next thing you know, here we are, we're on this in my apartment complex on the blacktop shooting hoops, and you know, word of mouth doesn't take very long, and the next thing you know, there's guys from the neighborhood that have come in, and we're playing 5-on-5, and I'm scared to death because I'm thinking this, I'm gonna lose my job. I'm what, 20 30 or 33 years old, I got four kids, and I'm going to lose my job. And it should have been televised because watching what he did, it amazed me when you put a basketball in his hands, how strong he looked. And then when you put a bat in his hands, how normal he looked. It was amazing to me.
Yeah. How mortal he looked with it playing baseball versus that. Yeah, exactly. Tim loves to tell the story about you setting a pick for Michael.
He put the ball, you know, he put the ball like in the crook of his arm, and he had told that he was getting irritated at a guy that was kind of trying to push him around a little bit. And so he pointed to the guy and he goes, hey, I'm going right there. And I'm like, oh, no. And I went over to set a pick, and he picked the ball up, and he put it, you know, under kind of in the crook of his arm, and he goes, get out of here. And so I kind of waddled away, like kind of embarrassed. And he took one step, and I remember thinking, ah, no, this is not going to end well. And the rim was bent. He came crashing down. He'd slammed the ball through the chain link net and knocked the guy down, was standing over him. And he said, hey, don't ever talk to me at my house. And I'm like, game's over. That's it. Time to go home. We've seen enough. Cause I thought this, I mean, I'm glad I saw it, but I also wanted to keep my job.
Now, you know, I had some sense of his relationship that he had, you know, with Jerry Reinsdorf, who, of course, you know, owner of the Bulls, owns the White Sox as well. Did you get any kind of a guidance from folks way on high on sort of handle that?
Yeah, I did, actually. Not a ton, but a couple things were they didn't really – they weren't all that thrilled. George Kohler was a guy that was Michael's – I don't even know what you'd call him. It's his guy. You know, he just – you know, at George had met him as he was a dry limo driver, and they hit it off. And they didn't want George around, like, in the dugout and things like that. And I kind of found out pretty quickly that having George around was way better. So we kind of got him a uniform and told him to be a little bit low-key, because he was low-key anyway. That was the thing. Like, he was – his eyes were on a swivel 24 hours a day, but he was not a confrontational guy. And I just thought, hey, this is going to be way better. And you know what? It was. This guy helped diffuse more things that could have happened. And he was just another set of eyes. And he knew Michael, and Michael trusted him. And to this day, I talk to George probably more than I talk to Michael.
There, as you remember, the infamous article from Sports Illustrated with a cover that said, "Bag it, Michael." Again, you spent your whole life in baseball, and yet you'd been around Michael. How did you feel when you heard about that?
You know, and I knew the guy that did it too, because I'd known him for a long time, and I'd even talked to him after that, you know, about it, and, you know, knew his feelings on it, how it, you know, how he didn't feel real great about it. I didn't think it was fair. Again, I had an inside seat. So I knew that Michael wasn't taking anybody's place. And, you know, I just didn't think it was that bad that the guy wanted to play baseball. I didn't think he was hurting anybody. You know, did I think he was going to be good enough? I don't think we knew yet. And again, you know, things changed the next spring because of the lockout. It really put Michael in a tough predicament. But I will say this, when he went back to play basketball, I remember him calling me one Sunday on the way to the arena, and he said, you know what, man? He goes, I am enjoying playing basketball more now again. He goes, you guys love doing what you're doing. And that made me feel so good, because it was that obvious to him that we love doing what we're doing. And that made me feel really good.
And Tito, it really feels like that you guys developed a really great connection that still lasts to this day.
I think so. I'll get funny texts every once in a while, you know, when things are happening or if something crazy happens, and, you know, or just he's got kind of that way about him, or he'll, you know, like I said, I see George every time we go to Chicago. He comes out, we talk and laugh and tell old stories, but I try not to say hello too often, only because I've seen how he's lived his life and how people want to get at him. And I almost think it's disrespectful. I, you know, you don't have to bug a guy to prove that you're friends with somebody. You know, I mean, he's terrific. I love the guy, but I don't need, you know, again, I bet you he's getting 100 texts every hour. He doesn't need to get one more from me.
And I got to tell you know, that in the time, the closest thing that I ever saw to that was Derek Jeter covering him for 4 years. And I told friends, I'm like, I would not want his life for anything where no matter where he goes, someone's asking him for something, and how difficult that would be.
I was amazed at the way he handled things. I mean, you know, we love to golf together, and we played a lot. And his the way he would diffuse things that I frankly probably wasn't ready to. You know, I was probably more ready to maybe go stick up for him or say something. He just pat you on the leg and say, hey, let it go. it'll pass. And I remember thinking, man, some things, said in the South back then, it bothered me. And he goes, oh, it'll be okay. And it just amazed me.
Well, I hadn't heard that you guys experienced that. That would have been awful to be around.
And again, it wasn't often, but there were a couple times, remember being at Shoal Creek Golf Course and we were eating and we heard, I heard some comments and, it was killing. I was humiliated. And he just looked at me and said, hey, let it go, man. It's all right. And that was it. We kept on eating.
Last one for you. I'm assuming that at some point, when he returned to basketball, that you got a chance to see him in person. I'm guessing he probably helped you get some tickets. And I'm thinking to myself, you must have had like this weird special pride as a friend of his watching him play that game that he loved so much.
You know, I have two funny stories, and I never ask him for tickets. I wouldn't do that.
Okay.
But when he came to Philadelphia, now I'm a manager with the Phillies, and I took the clubhouse guys, and we sat on the floor. I bought tickets, and we sat on the floor, and MJ being MJ, he came over a couple times, like he was dribbling down the court, and he would kind of come over towards us, and he'd be like, Tito, this is for you. And then he'd like do some, 360, and the clubhouse guys were like, you got to be kidding me. This is unbelievable. And then a couple years later, still with the Phillies, they were playing in Chicago. They were playing Indy in the playoffs. And I took Millsy and Galen Sisco and we bought tickets. And we sat behind the basket about 10 rows up. And at halftime, the security guys came up and they said, hey, MJ wants to see you. I said, where? And they said, back in the locker room. I said, I'm not going back there. And they's like, no, you got to go. So I go back there and, they're coming out by now and it's Pippen and Rodman. And, here I am in my Friday night going out sweater that looks like I'm from Happy Days. Big hug. I said, I'm like, hey, man, you're all sweaty. Get off of me. And we made a little side bet on the second half. And it was funny because, there's a lot going on. And when he hit that point, he looked at me. He knew Rob Ross sitting in the stands. I remember thinking, oh, God, I got to go to the ATM machine.
Oh, that's so cool. Having gotten to know you and worked with you, I can understand why he has such trust in you, Terry.
You know what? Buster, it goes both ways. And I appreciate you saying that, but it goes both ways. If he learned as much about baseball as I did from him about a lot of other things, then he was okay.
That's awesome. I appreciate it, Tito.
You got it, Buster. I enjoyed it, man.
Here's Tim Kirchens, Baseball Fix, this about Kirby Puckett.
Hi, this is Tim Kirchin, and on this date in 1984, Kirby Puckett got 4 hits in his major league debut. He was a hit machine, and later on that year, Tom Grieve, the GM of the Rangers, watching Puckett in the cage, said, if this guy ever learns David Power, he's going to be the best player in the game. And 2 years later, Puckett became the first player ever to have a 30-homer season following any season in which he had 0 homers in 500 at-bats. But he was not about the numbers. He was all about that engaging smile and that incredible energy. He famously told his Twins teammates before Game 6 of the 1991 World Series, "Get on my back, boys. I'm going to take us home." He made a great leap in catch in that game. He got 3 hits, including a walk-off homer. And Randy Bush, who was one of Puckett's teammates, told me the best 30 minutes of every day with the Twins was the 30 minutes right before the game. All the media was gone and Kirby went locker to locker, pumping everyone up and getting them ready to play the game. He said there was nobody like Kirby Puckett.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Friday. First one up, Jeff Sandvik at JC Sandvik. He writes in, listening about the Batista bat flip got me thinking, football fans seem to have no problem with celebrations. So who does? Does ESPN have any numbers of baseball fans that don't like football? Is this a small minority ruining it for us all? And it's an interesting point because football fans do love the celebrations. And when the NFL took them away, there was a huge outcry. So it's a, I guess it's an interesting look at the two kind of demographics of people that, that watch these sports. What do you think?
I don't know about that crossover, but I'll tell you where I think the root problem is with baseball in terms of its response to bat flips is that there's so much failure in baseball that among baseball players, the thought process is maintain an even keel. You have to maintain an even keel because you got an 0 for 4 today. You might have an 0 for 4 tomorrow. And so to celebrate too much on any particular hit, they feel like will affect the even keel. I think that's at the root of this. And historically, you know, players, they don't like to celebrate too much because they, you know, they know that the next 0 for 15 could be right around the corner.
Mm-hmm.
And the bat flipping kind of runs counter to that.
That makes sense. Aaron at Aaron San Diego writes in, Jim Leland, an emotional guy sharing stories about Al Kaline, got me all emotional about baseball. What is each of your favorite baseball related memory that you shared with a family member or close friend? Quickly here, I remember, I mean, this is so pathetic given the recent history of the Baltimore Orioles, but when they won that 2012 one-game playoff against the Rangers with my guy Joe Saunders on the mound, I watched it with my whole family the night before my cousin's wedding. We watched it like in this conference room at the hotel, and we were all just losing our minds. Everyone has their own teams, but we all love the Orioles, so it was a fun evening. What about you, Buster?
Well, for me, I always think about Brielle Saraceni. This 9/11 happened, and her dad was one of the pilots he was a pilot on one of the planes that went into the towers. And she grew up in New Jersey. She was a big Yankees fan, and she, you know, was having a difficult time right after that happened. And word got to the Yankees that Brielle, 12, 13 years old, was a big Yankees fan. And so one day I was in Yankee Stadium for a workout. This was like just before the playoffs started that year. And there was this girl who was standing next to the batting cage, and Derek Jeter was talking to her, and all the other Yankees coming over and talking to her. And they were like giving her Yankee jackets and batting gloves and handing her bats. And she just had the biggest grin. You know, I've got to know Brielle through the years, 10 years after 9/11. I talked to her about those days and about going to Yankee Stadium and about the call she got from Derek Jeter saying, hey, I want you to come to Yankee Stadium. And she said that was the best day of my life. And it's always made me emotional to hear when she talked about the impact of that. And you think about the impact that players can have on people's lives. She's a wonderful person. Last time I saw her, she was working for the Yes Network. I still think she does. Great person. And I get emotional thinking about Brielle.
That's an incredible story. More than just a game, Buster. You know that. Last one for today, Debbie Gammons Brown. The chorus of people wanting to see this is growing, Buster. You're probably not one for selfies, but I think you owe the Baseball Tonight podcast audience a photo of what's going on with your hair. Buster, let's have it.
Debbie, look, I had to do television this morning. I was on the Cape podcast, and I explained all about the hair and took all the heat for the haircut. It is bad.
I'm digging that up as soon as we're off here.
So there'll be a re-air this afternoon of this morning's broadcast in case you missed it this morning, and you can see all about the hair. There are a bunch of tweets about it. It was definitely ugly.
Oh, good stuff, man. All right, that does it for Bleacher Tweets for the week. Don't forget to check out The Last Dance, and thanks for writing in hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter.
And that's it for today. That's it for this week. My thanks today to Terry Francona for that interview we did so long ago, Todd Radom, Taylor Schwenk. Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening, and stay safe.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.